welcome to 1001 Albums. Today we'll be talking Quadrophenia by The Who with Danny Burton. I went back to the doctor.
Had lost its way, and that we needed to relink with our roots, which was this neighbourhood where we are now, Shepherd's Bush, Hammersmith, West London, and our first big engagements where we'd found connected with our local mod audience and with boys that we'd been at school with. I felt the band needed to look back at its roots, and I thought the best way to do that was to look back at, you know, a young man who would be, if you like, a kind of a model of a combination of all of our boy fans from that period. And there's some confusion about the idea that this is also about the four members of The Who. In a sense it is, but it's not really about Roger, Pete, Keith and John from the band. It was about the fact that this boy looked at the band and saw himself in each of them. So that's why I brought it back to the mod days.
Welcome back to 1001 Albums, Dan Burton. How are you doing, Dan, in the last 2 minutes since we were last speaking?
I'm all right. I've had a slurp of coffee and I'm back, ready for the big one, for Quadrophenia.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you are listening to this and you haven't listened to kind of part one of our discussion, then go back and listen to that, where we talked about Tommy. And also Dan gave us a fascinating stories about, you know, recording with Entwistle and having rehearsals to do the Tommy play and all that, and meeting Townsend and stuff. So that's definitely worth checking out if you haven't. But this one now, what we're going to talk about is a album that is not in the 1001 Albums book. And when I started this podcast, that was one of the things I really wanted to do, was actually, let's try and put this right. We're not just going to go through and hear what these other journos and this guy Robert Dimery, who wrote this book, felt was in the 1001, but actually, what do we think should be in there? And Quadrophenia, as soon as because I do physically have the book, as soon as I flick through to 1973 and it's not there, you're like, what the hell? It's not there. Outrageous. Yeah.
It is. It's definitely outrageous. It should definitely be. I mean, who was the guy that compiled the list? Well, if he's British, he should be ashamed of himself, because it should be in there. You know, Quadrophenia is a typically British film and album, and it sort of documents that the life of of young people at the time in the '60s. So yeah. It's for me, he's got to be in there.
So we talked about your sort of history with Tommy and getting into The Who as a kid. What was your history with this album then?
So I was more into this album. So we talked before about, whether I'd listened to Tommy and heard it and stuff before I'd done the auditions. But, Quadrophenia for me was the album. It was the film and the album, because I identified with Jimmy, I could identify with that. Obviously, I was a little mod and coming from that kind of, really kind of bought into that, the mod way and the look and, everything about it, especially in the sort of early 90s, everything that was about mod, we loved. And it was all about trying to be, like a mod. That kind of, that early 90s kind of version, which was a little bit different, but it was still the same. We still called ourselves mods. A lot of my friends drove scooters. So for me, you know, I remember going to school, I think it was in the last year of school with my parka on, you know, and everyone sort of taking a piss. I went to, my school was like the worst school in London. It officially was. So I watched a programme once and it was Highbury Grove and it was the worst school. It was on a list, the worst school in London. And if you come out of that school at the end of the day without getting cut or beat or tied up or, you know, stuck in a cupboard or your head down the toilet, it was like, it was the worst kind of, you know, it was like a zoo. Human zoo where anything could go on and, you know, the kids just run it. So I remember coming in with a parka on and everyone like sort of taking a piss at me. What you got on there and stuff. But I quite liked that because I felt like I was different. I've always felt that kind of, you know, so that I was different from everyone else, you know, kind of felt like sort of isolated in a way. So I kind of really bought into that character of Jimmy and I've watched that film. I watched it hundreds and hundreds of times.
Yeah.
And I love the album. I got it on vinyl when I revisited vinyl and I got a record player a little while ago. I bought the vinyl and I can sit there and listen to it, you know, from start to the end. You know, it means a lot to me. So that's why, you know, I think, you know, everyone's different. Everyone's got that album that means a lot to you that kind of, I think it's because I was growing up and, you know, growing up in London and, you know, being sort of into songwriting and that sort of thing and being in a band, you know, there was always someone who wanted to sort of knock you down and sort of, so I felt like a bit different from everybody else. And that kind of, you need that, I think, as a kid. You need something to sort of hook onto and say, all right, well, I'm not the only one, yeah. You know, and so for good or bad, I kind of related to a lot of, you know, what Jimmy was going through. I nearly said Tommy then.
Yeah. Tommy goes through something a little bit different to Jimmy.
Yeah, yeah. I don't relate to him as much as
but
Jimmy.
This is really interesting because, so, and moving on from Tommy, like, you know, Tommy was such a grand idea, you know, and so over the top. Deaf, dumb and blind boy becomes this pinball wizard, then becomes a religious leader. It's just a crazy, huge idea. And then also at the same time, you'll know, as a massive Who fan, that Townsend was trying to make this Lifehouse project work as well.
Yes, yes.
And it's sort of, you know, basically been with him for the last 40 odd years, like trying to make this thing happen. He's never really, it's his great lost thing that he's never really managed to put together. And once again, that was this huge, great, big, grand idea. And he basically thought of like the internet, like, but in, like,
I know,
you know, like 1971 or something, that he
invented the internet before anyone had ever thought of it. It was, you know, that's quite a big thing.
It's amazing. He called it like the Matrix as well, which is like, well, that's the same as,
even, you know, that is strange. Yeah.
And so he had this crazy, huge idea. And once again, if we thought Tommy was hard to explain, this was just another level of, like, you know, it's in the future and there's this authoritarian government and all this sort of, and it's about the
Sounds
one
familiar.
Word. Exactly.
He's a visionary. He's not just a genius.
But then I think that sort of obviously fell to bits a bit, and he goes, and a lot of those songs go into Who's Next, which just is, you know, for me is probably my favourite Who album. I think that Who's Next is just the pinnacle of that band as the four of them, and Townsend's writing and everything. For me, I think that is the pinnacle.
I'd agree.
Oh, do you agree? Okay. Well, maybe we'll come back and do that one as well.
Part three.
But then when we get to then 73, it's like, okay, so that sort of Lifehouse concept sort of falls apart, and he's like, okay, fine, let's just use the songs and we'll just put out an album, we'll call it Who's Next, and we'll use some of the songs, we'll do some other songs, and then fine, whatever. And then it's like, okay, he's going to do another concept, but this time he thinks, right, let's make this closer to home. Let's look back at like my history. Let's look back at what was going on in London. You know, and just think about this. It had only been like 7 years. He's writing about 65 and in like 72, but it felt like a lifetime.
Yeah. I've not when thought you think of it about like it that. Like yeah. that. Yeah.
It's insane. Yeah. When you think like how much had changed from that period, that to me is the biggest like, wow. If there's ever been a more like a huge shift of time between seven or 8 years, 64, 65 to like 72, 73. Unbelievable that they were so different between those two periods. That's crazy.
That is. It is crazy when you think of, when I think back like 95 to like, you know, 2001, my head was still in the 90s, you know, so not that much had changed. But then we think about the internet, you know, there was a time when we didn't have internet. And then, you know, 7 years later, we was all on the internet and we all had phones and stuff. And so, you know, I think it is amazing. But yeah, to do it so soon and look back. I've not really thought about it like that before.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? But that I mean, that whole concept though, I think like, yeah, go in and just sort of say, okay, we're not going to do the big grand ideas, let's take it a bit closer to home and actually more think about, you know, what was going on with him at the time. I'll give you my little story about it. So this is, once again, it's similar to me for Tommy. I had the soundtrack album and I saw the film before I heard the Quadrophenia 73 album. So,
same for me.
Are you the same as well? That's interesting, isn't it? We've really mirrored each other. But yeah, so it was only, I mean, once again, we're sort of saying that it was ages. It was only like a couple of years, but yeah, basically I'd heard I'd seen the film and I heard the soundtrack. I bought the CD of the soundtrack album, which is great, by the way, and it's got some extra songs that aren't on the 73 album. Yeah. And it was only when I went to university and a guy I ended up being a pal share with, a guy called Simon, who was like a proper mod from the Midlands, where they'd much bigger mod scene than you get in Oxfordshire, which has no mod scene at all. Yeah, and he sort of had the you know, the quadruple CD or whatever, and I was like, wow, there's all these other tracks. Like, I had no idea. I just thought it was the songs that were on the soundtrack CD. So yeah, so once again, it was a funny one, really, coming to it from that with a film and with a soundtrack CD, and then having to go back and discover the main album. So you were the same, were you? It was more the film and the soundtrack.
It was a film. I didn't have the soundtrack. It was just a film.
What about Brighton this weekend, eh?
You're going to be one of the faces down there, then, are you?
What do you mean, going to be? I am one of the faces.
So what are we going to do about pills, then? I mean, if we're going to Brighton, we're going to need bloody millions of them, aren't we?
Buddy!
I don't want to be the same as everybody else. That's why I'm a mod, see? You got to be somebody, ain't you?
I don't give a monkey's arseholes about mods and rockers. There's always some cunt with stars and stripes on who wants to push you about.
You're balmy, that's what you are. I'll tell you what's wrong with you. You're schizophrenic, that's what you are.
I had the film. So someone gave me the VHS of a copy of it, and I had the film and I watched it over and over again. But I think that is the genius of both Tommy and Quadrophenia, that you have that visual, you have the film, that reference.
Yeah.
You have the great piece, you know, great art, pieces of music, albums, but you can come at it from a different angle. Like, you had the soundtrack and you had the you know, watch the film. I was just watching the video. So it wasn't as accessible then you didn't have iTunes. You didn't, you know, so if you didn't have it on CD, if you didn't have it on tape or vinyl, you know, you'd have to go out and get it and stuff. Whereas things are quite, you can get them straight away. Someone can tell you, you can just go and get it. But I had that film and I just, you know, I wore it out. But we're quite similar in that respect. But then that made me get the album.
The album in general, then, what do you think of it?
Well, obviously, I'm going to say I love it. But, you know, it's one of my favourite albums. It's not just because I'm a massive Who fan and, I love Pete Townsend's songwriting and playing and, I actually love that album. You know, I will put it on and I think that see, with Tommy as an album, you listen to it, it sounds dated. But, you know, some of Quadrophenia, it's timeless. It's one of them albums, you know. I mean, there's lots of great albums that sound just as good now as they did in 1969 or whatever. But for me, it's one of the... Again, it goes back to what it means to you, you know. So music is so subjective and, you know, we love different things for different reasons. And I guess it's where you heard it, what was going on for you at the time, you know, how it made you feel. Did you relate to it? You know, does it have a kind of is there a narrative in your head as well where you can place where you heard it? Sure. And that's why it's great that you're doing these podcasts about albums, because it's interesting that, you know, people, you know, stumble across different types of music and different albums. But for me, it's because it was that sort of time when I was, you know, quite young and I was feeling those feelings, you know, and not quite in understanding what was going on, and, you know, and I sort of latched onto the film, and that's why it means a lot to me. So now when I listen to it, obviously I'm listening to it with fresh ears, and I'm listening to it as a songwriter, and I go in a little more bit in depth with it, and hearing different stuff. But I still love it today as much as I, you know, loved the film when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
It's just the only other little personal insight that I had to it was I don't know if you know this, but I did, I was on Mastermind in 2008.
No, didn't know that.
You didn't know that. On the first round, I did the mod movement in Britain.
Fantastic.
And if you look on YouTube, you'll see my round about the mod round in Britain. And one of the questions that John Humphreys asks is, Irish Jack was the main basis for who in the album Quadrophenia? And the answer is Jimmy. And the real Irish Jack, this guy Irish Jack Lyons, who was one of Townsend's like best mates growing up, is like an old, I don't even know he's still alive, but back, this is obviously like what, 12 years ago. But I then get a phone call or an email from the BBC after it had been broadcast on TV, and they said we've been contacted by someone. They've said that they want your address and they'd like to send you something. Is like, are we okay to give them your address? And I was like, yeah, okay. And he said, oh, it's a person called Jack Lyons. And I was like, well, that's Irish Jack. Yeah. And so next few days later in the post, I got a big tube came through, like when you have a poster or whatever. And it's basically, I've got I'll have to dig it out and take a picture of it for the image.
Yeah.
It's like this massive poster all rolled like a sort of a montage of like pictures of Irish Jack and him hanging around with Townsend in the 60s and like his scooter and all this sort of stuff. It's fantastic.
Oh, wow. That is...
And he basically wrote me a lovely letter with it and said, like, you know, it was so amazing for him to like hear his name mentioned on TV and, you know, the fact that he was the inspiration for Jimmy, and it's like, you know, still really important to him. So, yeah. So thanks, Irish Jack.
Yeah, that's mad. That's brilliant. I'm definitely going to go on YouTube that later and watch you on Mastermind.
Well, I'm not going to put. I might drop a little bit in here. Actually, I've dropped it into the Oasis podcast a couple of times. So yeah, maybe non-Oasis people might be interested to hear that.
And your chosen subject:
the mod movement in Britain.
The mods in 2 minutes, starting now. Which of the two makes of motor scooter favoured by the mods has a name meaning wasp in Italian?
Vespa.
Correct. Which Friday night television pop music show, whose slogan was "The weekend starts here," was a showcase for the latest music and fashion?
Ready, Steady, Go.
Yes, at Easter 1964, which East Coast resort became the scene of the first confrontation between the police and mods and rockers?
Clacton.
When 97 arrests were made?
Clacton.
Yes, I'm the Face was on the A side of the only single released by The Who in their incarnation as The High Numbers. What was on the B side?
Zoot Suit.
Yes, in March 64, which celebrated mod band played on the last night of the Marquee Club's old Oxford Street premises and the opening night of its new Wardour Street premises?
The who?
The Yardbirds. Which character in Quadrophenia is said to have been based on Irish Jack, a mod and friend of Pete Townsend?
Jimmy.
Yes.
But yeah, I wasn't a proper mod like you though, Dan. I was like, I was sort of, you know, I had the hair and stuff a little bit, but I was, yeah, I wouldn't have claimed to have been a mod. I've never like ridden a scooter or anything. I was just really interested in the history of it and the music and the style and the scene and everything. So, yeah, that was more my thing rather than actually living the life.
Yeah, no, it's I can understand that. I mean, it's I don't really buy into the whole, you know, I love mod. I always feel like a mod, but I don't buy into it. You know, if real mods would probably say, it would say I'm not a mod because, you know, I don't buy into, you know, having to wear all the same stuff all the time and all of that. But, you know, when I was young, that was, you know, that was, you know, we wanted to be, you know, we all looked the same. So it was, it's a bit like, you know, there's a line in Quadrophenia where, you know, they all, it says about, they all, you know, all dressed the same and we're all the same. And that was a bit like that kind of movement in the early 90s, in the mid-90s with the so-called, what they call Britpop thing, yeah. You know. And we kind of, it was just another form of all sort of looking the same and being part of something, you know. And that scene in Camden.
There's that brilliant line where he says, like, I don't want to be like everyone else. That's why I'm a mod, see?
Yeah. I know. Yeah. I watched the film the other night and, oh, it's, you know, it's a classic. But, you know, there's lots of little things in that, you know, where he goes in the pie and mash shop and he says, you know, yeah, double bubble, pile on the liquor, you know, and it's like, and he sits down. And that's what we used to do as kids. We used to go in the pie and mash shop before we used to go and watch the Arsenal on a Saturday.
What's the matter with you, then? Well, that gear you got, it's leather. That's it, it goes with a bike, doesn't it? I never realised. You never realised what? Well, you's a rocker. Well, my black or something?
Well, you ain't exactly white in that sort of get-up, are you?
Nah. Give us a cup of tea, mate, please.
Anyway, how long you been back?
A couple of months ago. Yeah.
You couldn't stick it, eh?
Nah, missed me a bad, didn't I? They treat you like a lump of shit. There's some pulse of a sergeant major there. What's all you about all the time? Don't do this, don't do that. You drove me fucking mad.
There was so much that I felt that it was about my life, you know, yeah. Because, you know, although I didn't have a scooter when I was young, I did have, it was funny enough, it's called a James. It was an English version. It's like the British had said, the English had said, all right, well, everyone's driving these Vespas and Lambrettas. We're going to make one. But it was like a tank. It was the English version. It's called a James. You can look them up. It was lovely, though. And so I had one of those. And I used to drive that around thinking I was a proper mod. And we used to come to gigs. Funny enough, we used to go to gigs in Camden. And because you had to wear your helmet, I used to stop around the corner, take off the helmet, make sure my hair was all right, and then turn up at the gig on the scooter, just like go around the corner as if I'd been driving it all the way. I mean, that's how much I wanted to be like the ace face, like the mod. But yeah, so luckily enough, I never got nicked for that one.
And the one of the things that's like the irony as well about the whole thing is that both the album and the film are basically saying, like, it's not the answer, right? Like being part of this group is not the answer. You know, be yourself. Don't feel like you need to go into this group to be a different, you know, to feel like you belong. The answer lies in, you know, in you, and don't just sort of try and be part of this group. But then obviously, as soon as the film comes out, it's like it then turbocharges this massive mod revival, which had happened like on the back of the Jam becoming massive, which is just sort of quite ironic, really.
It is, yes. I mean, and that's the thing, you know, not everyone got that. And I probably didn't get that. I mean, I wasn't the sharpest tool in the box when I was a kid anyway, do you know what I mean? And I didn't really see, you know, going to the school that I went to, you know, everything I learned after I taught myself or, you know, read or, you know, found out for myself. But sure. There's, you know, Jimmy is fighting against it. You know, he's fighting against it in his mind. You know, he's saying, you know, why should I care, you know, if I have to cut my hair, you know, you've got to move with the fashion and all of that, or be outcast. And I think he's got an inner battle where, you know, he's got to be something that he's not, and that is being a mod and, you know, keeping up with the fashion and doing all the things that he's got to do to be seen as a mod and to be sort of accepted by the group. You know, because it's easy to be an outcast, really, and even if you are in it, you could be on the outside looking in. So that's quite interesting, and I think a lot of people don't actually get what you said there about it being this is not the answer. You know, you can be an individual. You don't have to be, you know, you don't have to be part of this massive group and all look the same and all say the same things, all do the same things because everyone else is. Just be yourself. So that's an interesting thing, and I don't think that, yeah, I think a lot of people got it, but it kind of, there's so much stuff in the film that's attractive if you love, you're into mod and that, you know, because every time, you know, when I hear The Real Me, you know, I remember being on the scooter and I didn't have any headphones or whatever, and in my head I was, you know, at the start of Quadrophenia as I was driving down the road. You can imagine me back in the 90s.
Yeah, you know that it's all a bit silly and it's not the answer. And yeah, you're going to have to, you know, find answers elsewhere. But it's fun to be on a scooter and have great hair and be out dancing to amazing music with your mates, right? That's like, there's nothing better than that, right? And so,
yeah.
And being part of a gang like that is cool. Like I remember when I, like I said, when I went to uni, and it was a real eye-opener seeing like the Leicester mods, because there was a 60s night. There's a place called the Fan Club in Leicester, and it's like, it's still there now, but it's like a proper, like the dingy indie nightclub. And so there was a 60s night there on a Wednesday. And so me and my housemate Simon were like massive sort of fans of 60s music. And we go down there, and there were these kids, like they're probably only 17, 18, but the most immaculately dressed, coiffured hair, like, you know, back combed, looking like Rod Stewart in about 65, like suits.
Fantastic.
And you think, God bless you, you beautiful little peacocks. Like, you know, why the hell not? And yeah, they're probably arrogant little shits, but it's like, who cares? You know, you're out there, you're doing it, you look amazing, fantastic. You know, I think it's brilliant. And, you know, why not?
Definitely. And I mean, this is why it's such a big thing for me, to actually meet the Who, you know, when I did. And I'll tell you a funny story about that's related to Quadrophenia. And well before I ever thought that I was going to meet the Who, we went down, being good mods, we went down to Brighton, and it was a bank holiday, and we were down there, and it all went a bit weird and crazy with this group of people that I was with. And I ended up getting left in Brighton. So I was, you know, completely out of it. And then I went to the station. There wasn't a train. I think it was Sunday. There wasn't a train till Monday or something like that. So I walked back and I found this bike that had two punctured wheels and buckled wheels. So I started driving on this bike around Brighton. And because I was left there looking for somewhere to sleep. So I put the bike down, which I thought was mine at the time. And I put the bike down and leant against this door. And the door opened, and it was someone's house. So I went in the house. Now, don't ask me why. This is the craziest thing ever. I went into this house, and there was all people sleeping on the floor in sort of sleeping bags. And I just went and sat down in a chair, and this guy kind of looked at me, and he must have thought he was dreaming. And as I've looked up, there's the light from outside, the street light from outside is illuminating a Quadrophenia poster on the wall, and that's the only thing I can see in this house.
What?
And then I just thought, what am I doing in here, you know? And I kind of made my way out, got back on my broken bike, and as I went back down to the front of the sea, they turned up to pick me up, and then we sort of, no one said anything, we just went back to London and we didn't say anything. But, you know, when you look back, that's a kind of a weird, you can see it as a weird sign. I never knew I was going to meet The Who, and I think you can sort of, you know, I loved all that music and I loved The Who so much. It's just, I find it weird that you can materialise these things, you know, if you put enough, you know, and then a couple of years later, I was sort of hanging around with them, so.
That is crazy. What a weird story, eh?
It is a weird story, yeah.
So was it just like a squat or something, or like just the students just...
Yeah, I think it was like students' accommodation or whatever. But, you know, I have to say I might have been a little bit bit out of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, dear.
In a mind-bending way. So, yeah.
Just if we just talk about the album itself, like the music on this 1973 album.
Yeah.
So I personally, like, I'm going to be a little bit critical of it here again. I think, like we were saying in the Tommy episode, I think The Who really peaked in 71 with Who's Next. I think that is, you know, they've reached this zenith, really, of like all the four of them are playing together so brilliantly. I think that there's quite a few tracks on here have got that. Like, I think The Real Me has definitely got that. Cut My Hair, I'm One. I think these are absolutely brilliant songs. The one thing that I could do without, and if it was my, you know, if the album was remastered, say in the 90s or something, like, I think there's a bit too much synthesizer. I think it sort of dates the album a little bit, I think, you know, like wah 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 like that. I think if that had been strings, or if that had been like once again like an orchestra or something else, I think it kind of dates it a little bit. Maybe
You know, I never got that. You know, I listen, but you know, I don't know whether I'm not listening to it from, you know, being subjective about it. So, but yeah, I can see where you come from there. But I do think, yeah, I think it adds to it for me. You know that, and I don't think it dates, but I can understand where you're coming from.
My only other thing with it is I think that it's a bit country at times, a bit country rock at times, you know, and I think that's obviously where Pete's head was at the time. So you get like, you know, all that kind of in the guitar work. It goes a bit country-ish, and it's not really my sort of thing there. I think that, and that, there's a bit of that in Who's Next as well, but... Yeah, so at times like that, and I sort of think I maybe prefer it if it was a bit more stripped back and, like, you know, more sort of old school Who style, like 60s Who style.
Yeah.
When it sort of goes into those longer sort of more country-ish passages, I'm like, maybe rein that in a little bit. Is it in my head? I suppose it's quite hard to think about it. I've had to really sort of separate myself from it, from having known it so well, and just sort of think, okay, maybe if I was playing this to someone for the first time, what would they think about it? And I think it has got a bit of countryness about it in a lot of the guitar work, especially.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree to disagree with you. but, you know, again, I think it's all, you know, it's valid. It's, you know, that's what you feel about it. And I do think it's wrapped up, you know, albums are wrapped up. You know, you couldn't say to someone about, you know, their favourite album that they, you know, like, you know, that they'd listened to when they were growing up that meant something to them. I don't think they can disassociate from it.
Sure.
So it's all wrapped up. And again, it's subjective. For me, anyway, music is more than just the music. It's about the feeling. It's about what it means to me. You know, there's a visual in my head, and that's not just a film. You know, there's a visual of my own life, my own narrative. And there's even smells and places, you know, and everything. So for me, music is a far, far more complex thing than just listening to an album. And that's why, you know, because I feel like that's why I could never be a music critic.
Right.
You know, because it means too much to me. I'm too involved in it. And I guess that just comes from being a musician or a songwriter or whatever. Mm. And that's the same for me as from an early age, you know, even when I was a tiny little kid, I was always into music. And it's more than just the music. So, you know, I can see where you're coming from, but, you know, I don't
piss off.
Have this. Yeah,
piss
yeah.
Off and don't
yeah,
be rude yeah. about The Who.
No. We're all entitled to our opinions. They might not be right, James, but we're entitled to them.
one of the other things I was going to say, it's interesting about this, and if people don't know, the idea of quadrophenia is that it's schizophrenia, but four ways.
Yeah.
And it's about the character of Jimmy is basically being drawn in these four directions, and they roughly line up with the four personalities of The Who. And so, you know, like the helpless dancer is the romantic, and like there's the bellboy, which is the, you know, so there's all the, and I think he said at one point, it's the good, the bad, the ugly, and the mad. And it was like the good
that.
Him, the bad Daltrey, the ugly Entwistle, and the mad Moon. So
poor Entwistle.
I know, poor Entwistle. But what do you think about
that.
The whole overall concept like that, and the fact that with the idea of it being this is sort of four personalities?
I could see that. I mean, I've got my own kind of, you know, that's why I buy into it, you know, because, you know, that's why I don't drink anymore, because, you know, if I have a drink, I can turn, my personality turns into someone else,
right.
You know, and so I can relate to that, and, you know, my wife will joke that we call him Angus. that's my alter ego, my drunk alter ego, and I become someone else, you know, so I can relate to that. And I think we've all got that, but I really like the concept of the four, you know, but hope, you know, I hope I haven't got the four personalities. Two's enough. Yeah. Angus and me are fine. We're fine.
Although if Angus, you know, he can have a little break for a while and you could take over.
Yeah, that's it. Angus is gone now. We've sent him off. He's gone.
Angus is away. That's good. I think that just to get on to the actual playing on this, like I said, and I think that the real me like you mentioned it earlier, like On Your Scooter, and it's so brilliant on the album. But this is when I'm, when I, like, for my 13-year-old daughter, she's a bass player, and I'm just like, listen to this. Like, this is what bass playing is. And Entwistle on that, I think that the story is, you might know if this is true or false, but the story is that that was his rehearsal. Like, they just sort of hit record, and as he's listening to the track, and he's just like, boom, boom, boom. So hence, he's not really playing like a traditional bass line. He's just messing around. And that's the idea, that that was like, it was the, you know, it was his first playthrough, like just listening to it. And then they were like, yeah, that'll do. Just, that's it. Oh,
that's
perfect.
Yeah, that's totally believable, you know, to me, because I've watched him when we were in the studio at his house and he played on Substitute for us. He did it laying down on the sofa. So he was literally, he was horizontal. He was laying down and he was just playing. He was just, to watch his fingers, you know, it's all, you know, you can watch him on stage, and that to actually be in a room and watch him do it is absolutely amazing. It's something to be seen. And so I can totally, you know, see that he would just like be all over the bass and say, oh, we've taken that. That's the take, you know. So for me, that bass playing, and I know I can speak for Ronnie, the bass player that I've been, you know, in the band with since the, you know, since God knows when, too long. That for him is if you can play that, which he can, you know, and that's where, you know, if you can do that. So you're right to tell your daughter, you know, if you can play the real me on the bass, you know, because that is just, it's fantastic. I mean, he's one of the best bass players of all time, isn't he? If not the best. Yeah. But that shows that he's, because he's not just a bass player, is he? He's a musician, you know. He understands. Yeah. He was a proper musician, you know.
Yeah.
And a great guy as well.
Often he's playing lead, like often on a lot of these songs, especially where Townsend is often doing like, you know, because there isn't a second guitar live, especially. So, you know, you've got Townsend is playing chords and it's Entwistle's lead instrument, you know, but then you've got lead drums as well from Moon. So,
yeah, you know. The drums on that, you know, the album. I mean, I think the drums on Tommy as well. I mean, I personally love that style of drumming. I love Moon's drumming. But for me, like on The Real Me, the bass playing and the drums are just unbelievable. And you know, that was if I was in a band with those two guys, you know, you don't have to play as much. So Townsend doesn't have to play as much. He can play those chords and power it, and he can let them play. They're both playing in and out of it. Wonderful. Wonderful bass playing, wonderful drumming as well.
It shouldn't work, should it? Like,
not really. No,
you shouldn't have a band with a bass player going all over the place and the drummer going all over the place and the guitarist doing all kinds of, like, it shouldn't work. Like, it's such a weird one with the Who. We were talking about it. We did sort of an episode for the Oasis podcast about, like, the fantasy band draft. We were all picking our fantasy band members, and it's one of those where it's like the members of The Who are individually, like, in the top kind of, you know, well, some in the top one. Like, I think Entwistle's the best bass player, maybe McCartney. But, you know, like, Entwistle and Moon, they're just the best. Like, they're maybe the best in their own fields. But in a band, you should really have, like, one person that's playing, the lead instrument, and everything else sort of chills out in the background. Whereas with this, The Who, it was just this magic that the three instruments all work together so well, and obviously Daltrey at the front. It shouldn't have worked, but how the bloody hell they made it work.
Well, you've got to understand, though, is that Entwistle's timing is impeccable. So, like, he's holding it down. He's holding it together. Moon, you know, he might seem like he's all over it, but the his timing is just so bang on. That gives Moon that freedom to be in and out, because that's just his natural style. But Moon's timing, I mean, that bass drum that he's doing all the way through the stuff, and, you know, that's why I loved Zach's drumming, because he was taught by Keith Moon. That was who taught him to. That was giving him his first drums.
Yeah, wasn't Keith Moon his godfather as well?
Yeah, yeah, and he told me, you know, a few stories and that, and he'd say he used to kind of play with him, you know, like, because Keith Moon's, so he was like his mate, even though he was probably about 8 years old. He felt like Keith Moon was his mate and he adored him, and he took the time to give Zach his first drums and everything. So it was only just that he, you know, he was the only man to fill his shoes, really. You know, and I think he does a bloody good job.
Yeah,
he does. Yeah,
yeah. Oh, absolutely. But no, I mean, did you ever, like, having worked with Entwistle, I mean, like you mentioned, and it was brilliant that you found that and you put it online a few months ago, didn't you, that Substitute cover?
That's right, yeah, yeah.
I absolutely loved it. I mean, how did that come about? Like, but did you, John, did you want to play on can we do a Substitute? Or how did that...
Do you know what? I think it was, we were doing it. Zach was there. Obviously, Zach and even at that stage, Zach had played quite a lot with The Who. I think it was late night. I think John had been holding court in the bar, telling us these great stories about, you know, and I was asking him all sorts of questions, you know, about Jim Morrison and that. And his words were, I said, you know, what did you like The Doors? You know, you met, because they played a lot with The Doors, didn't they? And I was really quite into Jim Morrison at the time. And he said, so I never liked The Doors. I never had a bass player. So it's like, you know, that was just typical, just a little one-liner. And I think it was just like, we were in the bar, and then Gary Granger, who played with Rod Stewart, was playing guitar on that, because we didn't have a guitarist because they'd left. Zach was playing, and then I think it was Bob Pridden who said, come and got the ox in to do it. And he was like literally laying down doing it. I've never seen anything like it. But that was probably how it come about. It was probably, we probably sort of said, come on, do it. And then he done it. I don't think he would have offered himself up to do it, but I bet he did it, and he was glad to do it, and it was great that he did it. I'm so glad. What an experience to have. You know, I can. It's one of the times I can actually remember for some reason. So I can, like, I clearly in my mind now I can see him, you know, just on the sofa behind the desk, you know. And he was just there. Zach's in the other room. I can see it. It's, you know, clear.
Amazing.
So, yeah, what an experience. Now you never look me in the eye. No crocodile tears will watch you cry. It's a genuine problem you won't try. So walking on a cloud, just passing by. Substitutes me for him. My coke for gin. Substitute you for my mom. Please help get my washing down. Substitute your lies for that. I see right through your blessing mag. I know go wild, but my dad was black. My substitute you made out of sack. He was always about, and he was always... He was so good, you know. He had a massive room upstairs that was like had thousands of guitars that he collected over the years, and he'd let us go up there if we needed. You know, we were like, you know, kids in a toy shop up there. He had every type of guitar, you know, and if we needed something, and he came in, he said, "Oh, that, you know, that might sound good," and that, and he let Ronnie play his bass, and you know, so you know, Ronnie was a little. I don't know. He wasn't put out that. You know, you can't be put out that Entwistle was going to play the bass on Substitute. But it was probably hard for him because, you know, he obviously played on everything else. But, you know, we couldn't say, no, John, you Ronnie's going to do this, because, you know, we all knew that this was a, you know, a sort of moment in history that we remember at the time.
Yeah,
but absolutely. No, he was a great guy. He was always lovely, and he was always there with his, you know. It took him a little while to warm up, you know, when he's like Dracula. He only come down at night. Right. And so, like, he didn't see him in the day, and he'd come down at night, and then he'd hold court for till about, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, and then we'd all crawl off to bed. But yeah, it's good times, man.
And did you see him then again much more between after those sessions and then obviously when he sadly died?
I've seen him a couple of times. He come to a couple of our gigs, which was quite bizarre when we was in Face with Zach. And he, you know, playing when you're on stage and you look over to the side of the stage and there's fucking End Twister at the side of the stage, you know. it's quite exhilarating and off-putting at the same time, do you know what I mean? And then I remember we had a after-show party, and then that lasted about, you know, 2 days. And that was a good couple of days. And then I seen him a couple of times with Zach, and then I saw them at the Quadrophenia in Hyde Park, and then that was pretty much it. I'd see Townsend after, obviously I told you that story on the Tommy podcast. But no, and then after that, really, I didn't see anyone. So I kind of, it was all like the arse sort of fell out of it for me. And, yeah. and it's quite hard at the time, you know, to watch them when you turn on the telly and you see these people that you'd been friends with and everything, and then, you know, not really being part of it.
Mm.
But, you know, that's the way it goes. That's the way it goes, you know. So, and... Mm. It's one of those things.
So, any other thoughts or comments on the album Quadrophenia?
Well, 5:15 has got to be one of the best tracks on that album, and I can relate to that as well. You know, that being on the train and being out of your brain, you know, and like getting that, and you know, and everyone looking at you, and it's rush hour, and you know, those little things I can relate to. But my favourite is Love, Rain on Me.
Yeah.
For me, that's like got a special, special place in my heart. You know, I've put it on in all sorts of times. We're going through shit in my life and stuff, and it's one of them ones where just them opening, you know, it just gets me. And I've got to say, that is probably in my top 10 all-time tracks, if not in the top 5 really? Of all time. Yeah, and, you know, of all tracks, not just Who tracks.
Mm.
So for me, that's a real special song. And I love the way that it teases you with it all the way through the album, you know, and the way through the film. And that kind of conjures up lots of images for me, you know, when I'm listening to it. And so I think that this album, Quadrophenia, should have been on the list, you know. And you know, at the end of the day, it's just a list. For me, it's one of my favorite albums of all time. But yeah, especially that track.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that it's hard to pick out. Obviously, you've got like 5:15 and Love Rain Over Me and the what was it, and the Real Me and stuff that are specific songs. But a lot of them, because I really see this as an overall piece. Like, it's hard to actually pick out like, oh, this track's good or this track's good, because it really is just one overall piece for me. And especially when you've got, you know, there's certain songs that, like, if someone played me a bit, you know, I could, you know, if you played me a 10 seconds of an Oasis song, I could tell you what song it was, right? Easy. Whereas this, I'd be like, well, it's one of the Quadrophenia ones, but I don't know, because, you know, there's certain bits that come back in, like, Cut My Hair. You look at Cut My Hair and you're like, okay, I know what that song is, but then all I'm thinking is the
why should I care if I have to cut my hair? I'm not thinking about all the other stuff when it's then all these other bits that go back in and out, and they were so aware of their history, like we were saying at the start. Like when he's going, and the face, baby, is there clear. Bits like that, Zoot Suit, Jacket Sad Bits. And that's like from the song Zoot Suit they did in like 64 when, as the High Numbers. So clever that they were able to take those bits from their life and just sort of, in the middle of a different song, it will suddenly shift into something different. I wear a suit, suit jacket with side bands 5 inches long. 5 inches long. And then, but I think that is, that does sum up, like we were saying about the four personalities, because he'll be in the, you know, like you said, it's like that leitmotif of the so he'll be, something else is going on, and that's like where his head is at, like with the, you know, whether it's like just rad for a street fight like that, and that's, he's in his street fighter mode, but then this will come in and it's like, oh no, that's his, that's like the romantic in him is calling at him, and
yeah, it's, that's why I love it,
you see what I mean?
Yeah, that's why I love it, because that's what goes on, you know, that's the genius, you know, we can't underestimate this piece of work as a piece of work that's up there, you know, with the great artists, you know, musical artists of all time, because to be able to do that, to be able to visualize that, to be able to piece it all together, to be able to make it coherent, is in itself genius, you know, the way that we're talking about it now. But yeah, but that's what you would do, you know. That's why I love it, because I can buy into that. I can relate to that, you know. I'll be doing something, and I'll be, you know, and I'll be one person, but there'll be saying girls going on in my head. And I think we're all like that, you know. We've all got that to a different degree than other people. Some people, you know, that might be going into madness. Other people, we've always got those voices going on in our head. We've always got those, you know, those little ifs and buts, and you know, you might be doing one thing wishing you were doing another thing. And I think that is, you know, you've hit the nail on the head there. That's the genius of it.
And he's nailed it in music, and using leitmotif, you know, this sort of operatic thing that like Puccini does and Wagner does. And he's doing it in rock and roll, which, you know like a few years before, you've got everything's just in a you know, 4-5-1, and you know, everything's just rock and roll. It's just, you know, and then the Beatles, Buddy Holly throws in a few more chords, and then the Beatles go, oh, okay, well, let's take a bit of ideas from country and a bit of ideas from, like, you know, musicals and things like that, and let's mix that up a bit. And then you've got Townsend just goes like, all right, I'm making this into a bloody opera. I mean, it's like, it's unbelievable, really. It's once again, it's another huge step on. And yeah, and as we said at the start of part one, I think that personally, I think that the only reason why it's not in the book would be because, you know, Tommy was the groundbreaking thing, you know, was the rock opera. Who's Next was maybe the best collection of songs and the band at their peak. And then Quadrophenia is like, oh, it's another one. It's another rock opera, you know, and it didn't, you know, live, they couldn't really pull it off live, so it was never played live properly until like the 90s, and so it hasn't had that cultural impact that Tommy had, as in all the stage plays over and over again. I know it has had sort of some stage runs, but it hasn't had that same cultural impact. But I think for UK as well, maybe it is because the film, actually, that because people generally think of the film, because it's such a an iconic film and it's so important in the history of British cinema, it is almost maybe it's because the album's overshadowed by the film, maybe.
Quite possibly. You know, I can understand. Yeah, I can understand what you've just said there, why it wouldn't be in. But, you know, I do think as a piece of work, you know, I would put it this way, I would love to be able to be that good, you know, to to articulate my ideas and my visions in my head and put them down into, you know, it's hard enough putting it down into one song, you know, but putting it into a collection of songs that all go into each other that become a piece of work, you know. But, you know, this again, there's still time, James.
Still time, mate. There we go. The concept album. Well, you know,
yeah,
I was
God
chatting
forbid.
To our kid, A-R-G-H kid, you know, Dave Scott, who's a rapper and poet and stuff. And he was saying, like, I was thinking I could do a concept album. And it's like, brilliant, bloody do it. And he's like, well, I know these days, like, everyone just does, like, one-off tracks. And that's what, you know, Spotify and everything, it sort of just encourages YouTube, it encourages you to do one-off tracks rather than concept albums. But I think it's going to come back. I think that the time is right for, you know, a piece that's like, you know, 45 minutes long or an hour and a half long if it's like an old-fashioned double album, and just like an overall piece. Like, I thought that the second Streets album, A Grand Don't Come For Free, that was a concept album, you know, a full story from start to finish, and it was like that's in the book. That's one of the best albums of the last sort of 20 odd years. So go on then, Dave.
I've had a go before. I have had a go, and I don't know if it was any good, but I'll dig it out. But I would like to, and I think we should be able to experiment. We should be able to, because music, you know, nowadays is so accessible. Every type of music we can, or at our fingertips, we can access any information that we want. You know, why should we be pigeonholed, you know, as an artist? Why should we have to do this stuff? You know, you can put it out quite easily now. So, you know, experiment. And I think, you're right. I think it will come round where it's, you know, it's cool again to do that. But whether it's cool or not, I think as an artist, it's as an exercise in your songwriting ability. Mm. You should have a go at it. I'm going to have a go right now, James, when we come.
Well, I best go then. I best go and let you write the next Quadrophenia Part 2. How about that?
I'm not gonna take that. No, I can't do that. But I'd have a go. If Pete Townsend wanted to say to have a go with him, but I wouldn't do it on my own. But I definitely have a go at my own one.
Is it about a deaf, dumb, and blind boy that rides a scooter? Because that's not going to turn out very well.
Oh, that you just took my idea there. How did you know what I was thinking?
Oh, damn. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate, over two episodes.
I think we've got
two banged on, nailed on, amazing albums for the 1001.
Good stuff. Thank you for having me on, mate.
All right, really, brilliant. And we'll just remind the guys, if they want to find you online, what's the best place?
Yeah, on the socials are at This Is Dan Burton. That's Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Website dannyburton.co.uk, and on Spotify, Danny Burton, and iTunes and Deezer and all the rest. Go and check it out. We've got a new EP coming out in September. We've got a single coming out in September, which is called Tuesday, and that's going to be pre-released next week, which is about 6th of July.
Very nice one, mate. Wonderful.
Good stuff.
Thank you, mate. Much appreciated.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I feel I must warn you, Cooper, that we cannot tolerate this kind of absenteeism amongst our junior staff. You've got a good steady job here, Cooper. Plenty of young men give their eye teeth to be in your shoes.
Yeah? Well, find one then.
I beg your pardon?
You heard? I said find one then. Yeah, I'll tell you what you can do with your eye teeth and your job. You can take that mail and that franking machine and all that other rubbish I have to go about with, and you can stuff them right up your arse.